I'll be coming for your love, okay? Welcome to the Sapphicast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Welcome, everybody, to the first official summer episode of the Sapphicast 2016. It is indeed summer, and a heat wave is currently gripping the nation right now, and it's only about to get hotter, because episode 55 of the Sapphicast is now in your ears. But before we start talking about that, let's give you a little update on the Sundress Academy for the Arts, because, you know, that is kind of my job here at the opening, to inform you of these kind of things. It is June, and that means across the nation it is LGBTQIA plus Pride Month. And as you've been noting, I'm sure, this has been a Pride Month that is both up and down. I don't need to tell you why. I'm sure you're aware of it. I bring that up because it's once again time to tell you about the Sundress Outspoken Project. Every year, Sundress Academy for the Arts and Sundress Publications takes the voices and writings of LGBTQIA+ writers, transforms them into a stage production for the general public that allows those voices to be heard loudly and clearly. This year, our third annual performance is taking place. If you're listening to this on the day of the release, on Thursday the 23rd of June, well, you're just in time to get your last-minute tickets for this year's performance, which takes place this Saturday the 25th at 8 p.m. at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church in Bearden, Tennessee, which is a nice little suburb inside of Knoxville. But that's splitting hairs. To get your tickets and information, you can visit sundresspublications.com/outspoken. You'll see a link for tickets. I encourage you to attend this if you are in the general Knoxville area, the general Tennessee area. Show your support. This is truly a worthwhile cause. I've spoken of that, and I've tried to express that many times on this program, how worthwhile this is. These are voices that desperately need to be heard and heard loudly all across the country, and this is truly a wonderful thing. But let's say you're listening to this maybe on the weekend, maybe the day of the performance, maybe a wee bit afterwards, and you wonder, well, it's over, what can I do? Well, the Outspoken Project could still benefit from your time, talent, and treasure. To find out how you can participate and get in on this for the 2017 performance, or in other ways, visit sundresspublications.com/outspoken, and you'll find more information there about the project, the workshops, and much, much more ways that you can support the project as well. Perhaps by getting an Outspoken t-shirt, or by sponsoring a writer to visit the workshops, or perhaps another way. And if you want, you can even shoot us a message here at sapphicast@gmail.com, or any of the board members of Sundress Publications, and they'll be happy to get you involved. Again, I tell you, this is a very worthwhile cause, allowing the chance for LGBTQIA+ writers and voices to be heard loudly and clearly, more important than ever. And speaking of important voices, a new important voice will be coming into your ear in just a moment. I am speaking, of course, about today's guest. Poet Chen Chen is on the program, coming out of Texas. It's occurred to me that we've had a lot of Texas writers on this program. I'm not complaining. You know, it's just something I happen to notice and think about as we're recording this one. In any case, Chen was an awesome person to chat with, and I know you'll agree as we get into conversations about language, about traveling, and then hit on the topic of television, particularly Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And we learn, where does Chen fall on the question of Riley, Season 4, good or bad? Stay tuned to find out, but first, let's have a little bit of our theme song, shall we?
Hi, How's it going?
It's going pretty good. How are you, man?
Good. I'm excited for this.
I'm excited to have you on the program, man.
Cool.
I always like to start off the interviews on the Saftcast, kind of the conversation, with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
Okay.
And the burning question this time is, if you were given the power to learn any one language instantaneously, what language would you pick and why?
Oh, God. I've actually been thinking about trying to brush up on some languages that are in my family or that I've studied. So I would probably answer Mandarin Chinese, actually. I mean, that's a language that I've grown up speaking and that I have studied formally in college, but it's one that I kind of keep going in and out of in terms of skill level. I mean, when I've studied abroad or I visit family in China, it got really good for like a month. And then I would come back and I'd be away from family and friends. And I've lived in places where I haven't really been able to practice it in any organic way. So that would probably have to be the one, just so that I could just sort of have it and use it.
At any time you need it.
Yes, exactly.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
You were born in China?
Yeah, in 1989. And I came to the U.S. when I was about 4. Yeah, so a pretty young age.
Do you have many memories of early childhood in China?
Not really. I feel like all my memories of that time are probably actually photographs and stories that other people have told me, sort of patched together rather than things that I, you know, personally really remember.
So you came to the United States when you were about 4 years old, thereabouts. Was there a family over here in America and you were, you know, linking up with them, or what was the motivation?
No, there weren't family members here. It was, I mean, sort of complicated. There's a whole big story around it, but basically my father wanted to come study here. A bunch of his friends from back in China were doing study abroad programs in different English-speaking countries, whether that's the UK, Australia, the US. And my dad decided to come to the US because his dream was to get a graduate degree, a doctoral degree in the US. Both my parents were English teachers in China. So they had the language, basically, but coming here was really my dad's decision initially. And it was really, really tough in the beginning, because I think, even though, like for him too, like even though it was his choice, I think there were a lot of things that, I mean, you just can't really imagine or anticipate until you're here.
That goes for, I think, going anywhere. It's the nuances that are the hardest to deal with.
Yeah, I just can't really picture doing that. I mean, it's incredible that, like, my parents and from my mother, who's younger, you know, she was still in her 20s at the time, I think. So, and I'm in my 20s now. So to move somewhere, just pack up everything and leave everything that you know when you're an adult and you already have this whole life, you know? Yeah, I just can't imagine doing that. Like, I've tried to picture that. Like, I studied French in high school. So if I just studied French for several years, but to just go to France or another French-speaking country and decide, you know, like, my life is going to be here now, I think that's kind of incredible.
Yeah, it's one thing to move from one region to another, but another entirely separate culture in a way.
Yes.
Have you gone back? You kind of indicated you've gone back to visit.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you manage to get back to there?
Not very often because it's very expensive, but most of my extended family still lives there. I would like to visit more often, but yeah, the plane ticket is just very expensive, and some of the paperwork, visas and things like that are kind of a hassle to deal with as well. So it's something that you really need to plan well in advance.
When you do go back, what are some of the most kick-ass things to you?
Seeing some of my favorite relatives. my mother's younger sister, my aunt, is amazing. She's really fun to hang out with. And she has a kid, her son, who is, I think, in the third or fourth grade now. So it's really fun to see him, although it's also kind of depressing because his Chinese is already so much better than mine is when I go back. So, I mean, when I first saw him, I think it was in 2008, and he was still like a toddler. So that was nice. But now he's like so much more adept than I am with the language.
Four-year-olds can hose you, man. You just soak you with whatever they're thinking. Like, you sit there kind of looking at them going, I have no response to you.
Mm-hmm. And they'll just say exactly what they think, too. So,
children, no filters.
Yeah, and right away. Because sometimes, if I'm saying something more complicated in Chinese, I'll still have to, it can feel a little mechanical. Like, it'll have to go through my head. And then I'll be like, oh, I have the perfect comeback 5 minutes later, you know?
And by then, four-year-old's already forgotten.
Yeah, they've moved on.
Other than family, what else is awesome when you go back? What do you most look forward to?
The food. yeah, I definitely miss that. There's really good street food. Not so much where my family is from, but when I did study abroad, I was in this other region of China. I was in this city called Hefei in Anhui province, and it's not as frequented as other cities, major cities like Beijing or Shanghai, but it's a really cool city, and they just, yeah, they have amazing, amazing street food.
What's awesome about that city?
The street food, for one thing, and the university there where we stayed as students, and just the people were all like so welcoming, and the students at the university that we worked with, they like paired us up with their university students and sort of tutored us, and it was just really fun to hang out with them because, you know, usually learning Chinese in this way, you know, you're just kind of stuck in a classroom and in this very formal way, and you know, you have a textbook and these lessons, and it's regimented in this way. But to just go hang out with Chinese students who are, you know, your age with very similar interests in life, and just at this very similar stage in life, I just think, yeah, you learn so much more very quickly.
You're not going to learn the slang or the vulgarities in a classroom.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it'll come out from, you know, actually interacting with people.
I can see the benefit of the classroom, but there's a benefit to immersion as well.
Yeah.
So you said it was a study abroad. What were you studying while you were there?
I was studying the language for the most part.
Wasn't necessarily literature, but the language of it?
Yeah, and I was trying to do a little translation too. I was reading some of these short stories in Chinese. Yeah, start to do a little translation, or yeah, very short poems too.
I hate to delve into writing, but it's not going to be like the craft of it all. It's more about the thoughts behind it. Do you do a lot of translation work?
Not so much now. I would like to do more. That's part of why I came into the PhD program here at Texas Tech, because there's a professor here, wonderful professor, Curtis Bauer, who teaches translation classes. And I'm hoping to take a class of his that focuses on translation in the future. This past time, because he taught it in the fall when I came in, but it was a prose translation class, I think, primarily. And I also didn't have room on my schedule at that time.
What's the appeal of translation to you?
I mean, it's like poetry in that way, where you're pushed to think about language in such an intense and close way, such an intimate way. You're just getting into, you know, each word so deeply. So I think translation is a really fun challenge for really studying language too.
Sounds a little bit like a mystery novel in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're trying to figure out the clues.
Yeah, yeah. And there's so much, in translating a poem that, you know, you have all of these decisions to make and kind of what direction you want to take that translation in. You know, if you're really focusing on the sound of the words, the musicality, or, you know, you're getting just the most precise meaning across. And you know, you're kind of juggling these different concerns, and it's hard because you have to make these decisions.
Is it translation? Is it more about accuracy, or is it about taking some liberty with the language while still keeping the context of it?
I think it all depends on what kind of translation you want to make. I mean, I've seen translations that, you know, focus solely on the sound to the point where it doesn't matter so much what the semantics are, but they just want to get the sound across into English or whatever language you're translating into. But in other cases, it's really important to the translator that all the subtleties in meaning get across. So then you might end up sacrificing some of the musicality in that. You know, and I think especially with English, part of the issue is that it's not as rhyme rich as other languages are, you know, like Italian or Spanish, where you have these word endings that come up again and again. In English, we don't have that as much. So often when you're trying to reproduce the rhyme in English, you end up with something very sing-songy. Or it sounds like a lullaby, and I don't think that's the effect that you want to go with most of the time. So yeah, often the rhyme, the very strong musicality, ends up getting sacrificed. But other things could be preserved, like, you know, if there's alliteration or anaphora of some kind.
When it comes to your personal work with translating, which do you prefer? Are you aiming more toward accuracy, or are you aiming more toward the sound and the rhythm of the language?
I think it depends on the poem, because there are some poems that are more sonically rich, and then other poems that maybe rely more on narrative, and it's really important to get that story element across. So yeah, it depends on the poem, but I think probably I would lean in general more toward sound.
Away from the writing for a moment, let's break away. Cause...
Sure.
You know, that's all well and good, and that's nice and everything. But when you were growing up, did you grow up with siblings in China, or are you an only child?
I was an only child in China, but when my parents came here, well, because the one-child policy was in play. But when we came here, my parents had two more children, so I have two younger brothers.
Are you close with them still, or...?
There's quite an age difference. It's like 7 and 8 years. So, and they're only a year apart. So they're very close with each other. And when we were all younger and, you know, living under the same roof, we were quite close. But since I've lived in different places now, and yeah, I'm not back as often. Yeah. So they're still pretty close with each other.
When you came to the US, where did you guys settle at first?
In Texas, Fort Worth, Texas.
Was that because, as you were saying, your dad wanted to go on and get an advanced degree? Was that the reason he came to Texas?
Yeah, he started at Texas Christian University, TCU. But then he changed his whole course of study. He was studying religion. Then I think he decided to go into education, or maybe that was later. Maybe he did Chinese first. And then we moved to Massachusetts because he got a scholarship to study at UMass Amherst. So we were in Texas for a year or so, very short amount of time.
What made, and now you're at Texas again for your, going for the PhD. What made you come back to Texas? We've had other Texans on this show, native,
yeah.
And mm-hmm. What was the appeal of Texas to you?
I wasn't really planning on coming back to Texas, to be honest. I didn't think I would. It really came down to where I was getting in terms of the PhD programs and who was offering the best funding. Yeah, so it was kind of less about the region than the program. Yeah, Texas Tech's creative writing program is really wonderful. So I'm glad to be in the program, although it really was not my first choice to come back to live in Texas.
When you came back, did it feel, coming back to Texas, like it was a homecoming or like a completely different world all over again?
It felt like a very different world because I'd lived in the Northeast for most of my life in Massachusetts. And then I'd just been in Syracuse, New York for 3 years. So, I mean, obviously climate-wise, it's very different. But also, I think, because I was so young when I was in Fort Worth that, you know, again, I don't have super strong memories of it. You know, I feel like a lot of it's from stories that my parents tell or photographs that I've seen. And also it's Lubbock, Texas, where Texas Tech is. It's a very different city compared to, you know, the Fort Worth, Dallas area, which is a lot more urban and, yeah, just a bigger city comparatively.
Do you prefer the smaller paced life of, say, a smaller town like Lubbock, or do you prefer the bigger cities like Massachusetts and Boston?
I think I prefer the bigger cities. Usually there's better public transportation, which I really like. There are just more options culturally, you know, with food, with music, museums, art, that sort of thing. Yeah, there's just a lot more to do. Yeah, in the smaller city, you know, like in Lubbock, or I mean, Syracuse for that matter, too, was like this, where a lot of life, you know, revolves around the university. And, you know, sort of outside of that, it's harder to find things to do.
I totally understand. I'm right now recording this about 60 miles from Syracuse, visiting my family up north. And so I'm well acquainted with the Syracuse area.
Yeah, I liked living in Syracuse. And in some ways, I mean, living in Lubbock isn't terribly different just because my life situation isn't terribly different. You know, like I'm still living in a neighborhood that is predominantly students and teachers, close to the university. I'm on campus, you know, all the time. And yeah, a lot of the industry revolves around the university.
Pretty much a college town.
Right.
A lot of smaller towns, basically, that is the way. I noticed that in my hometown at Syracuse, you mentioned as well, and even where I went to grad school in Mississippi, same way.
Yeah.
Because some big cities, you'll be walking through a neighborhood and go, oh, I'm near college town.
Mm-hmm. And Texas Tech is a huge university. I'd gone to undergrad at a very, very small school, Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. Like, I think our graduating class had a little over 300 people. So tiny school to Syracuse, which was significantly larger, but still a private institution. And now this huge public university. I think it's something like 35,000 undergrads. And then all the grad students too. And I think by square feet, it is the largest campus in the country, actually.
Huh.
Yeah.
Seems like with every degree, you get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, well, Texas, too, you know. Everything is bigger.
Where do you go from Texas except Alaska?
Right.
Any desire to go to Alaska?
Maybe, yeah. I really want to go to Iceland. So, yeah, places that just have such a fascinating ecosystem, kind of their own, that seem kind of separate from the rest of the world in some ways, just because of, I guess, natural history. Yeah, so I'd love to go to these places that are kind of extreme in their own ways.
Iceland's pretty intense, I'm told.
Yeah, and they have such an array of natural landscapes, you know, from, you know, the lake, the Blue Lagoon, to these geysers, these natural geysers, and then ice and volcanoes and...
It's as if the entire world biomes are shoved into one small island.
Yeah, it's really incredible. I had friends who've been, and they say it's really, really incredible.
Are there other places similar to that that you'd like to travel to, like Australia, for example?
Yeah, I'd love to go to Australia. I'm not so good with the heat, though. That's the other thing about being back in Texas. Yeah, I think I do better in cooler climates. So if I were to go somewhere like Australia, I don't know, I would want to go when it's a cooler season, or if I went when it was hot for a shorter time. When I go back to China, it's like that too, because I've only been able to go during summers, and it just gets insanely hot there. My family's in the southeast, in this town called Xiamen, which is close to Taiwan, and it's kind of ridiculous.
So it's not in the, say, northern or mountainous regions necessarily of China?
No, it's tropical. There are palm trees. It gets up to 100 degrees regularly and really high humidity as well. Everyone takes, you know, a siesta, an afternoon nap. Because you just can't do anything.
China is one of those places I've long wanted to visit because it just seems to me like it's so amazing in terms of the scope and the range of things there to see and to do.
Yeah, there's a huge variety. I mean, region by region, city to city, it's so different. The regional dialects or languages are so different. You know, my relatives in China, they all speak Mandarin to varying degrees, but they all speak this regional dialect as well. And I used to be able to speak it when I was really little. And my parents still speak it from time to time. They'll kind of switch back and forth between Mandarin, this regional dialect, and English, you know, kind of very fluidly. But I've pretty much forgotten it. So when I'm at home or when I'm back in China, it's very odd sometimes because Mandarin is what I really know. But for some of my relatives, it's a very formal language or it's, you know, kind of a school language, official business kind of language. And they would just prefer to speak their dialect.
Has anyone told you that you have a particular accent or dialect in Mandarin when you speak?
Yeah, I definitely sound Southern when I speak Mandarin. When I've gone to other places, like when I went to Hefei for the study abroad program, yeah, people would tell me that. Because the standard dialect of Mandarin is based on Beijing, the Beijing dialect, but kind of less intensely Beijing, I guess. Yeah, so the way I pronounce certain words or use certain phrases, yeah, people have told me that, yeah, it sounds Southern.
It's like that's a dead giveaway. You just said that. I know where you're from.
Yeah, like when I've been in Shanghai a couple times, and with taxi drivers, they'll usually pick up on that very quickly.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing that they can pick up on it quickly.
I think it's kind of nice because people kind of take pride in that regional identity. That's really important to a lot of people. And so I think it's cool. I think it's nice that, you know, you put your own stamp on the language.
I'd say that because I think of the Southern accent and here in America, and it's regional breakdowns. Because mm-hmm. when I was doing theater and I had a Southern accent for a play, I was told later on, I was like, you have an Arkansas dialect. I'm like, that makes no sense. I'd never been to Arkansas. I don't know where I'd
be. Yeah, the way that we speak a language, I mean, it's influenced by so many different factors, like where we grew up, but also like where we went to school, you know, all the people who taught us the language, basically. And over time, that can sort of change depending on, you know, where you're living, who's around you, and all of that. And because this kind of Southern accent with Mandarin is how I was first taught the language, really. But it's also, you know, like, these are the people that I continue to speak it with, mainly, you know, my parents, relatives at home, friends of my parents. You know, that's what I'm hearing all the time.
Have you done much traveling other than China? Like,
yeah, I've been to Japan. I was there not too long, for like 10 days when I was in middle school, because our middle school in Amherst had this exchange program. And I remember, yeah, really, really wanting to go, just really wanted to travel from an early age. I'm not sure why, but it was hard to kind of get the funding and just make sure everything was okay, visa-wise and all that, to go. But yeah, I was able to go there. And that was incredible. We went to Kyoto, Tokyo, Hiroshima, and we have this sister city, actually, in the north, Kanagasaki, where we stayed with host families for 3 days. So that was incredible. And that really kind of started my urge to travel, my wanderlust, maybe. So then in high school, I went to France for a month. I was studying French. So that was another exchange program. I stayed with a host family in Paris. Also really, really fun. And then I've been to China several times. I think that's it in terms of... Oh, I've been to Canada. That was also a school trip for French. We went to Quebec.
Not a bad place to go. I've been to Canada a few times.
Yeah, it's just like... It's a drive. It's like, it's closer than cities in like Texas. It's hard to get anywhere in Texas.
Yeah, I think from where I grew up to Niagara Falls is 4.5 to 5 hours. That's it.
Yeah. I sort of miss about being the Northeast. The cities are so much closer. you don't have to travel kind of insane distances to get somewhere else. I mean, I used to think that like going from Boston to Syracuse was a long car ride, but now that I'm in Lubbock, Texas, getting anywhere, I'm flying a lot more. So we had a big snowstorm. It only happens like once every 30 years or something that they actually kind of have this blizzard. And I mean, compared to Syracuse too, this is like a small storm. I think it was like a foot of snow and then everything shut down.
It's like a warm August day in Syracuse.
Right. Yeah. Like the post office was closed. Well, school wasn't, because school was out, so that didn't matter. But yeah, everything was like not functioning for a week. We couldn't leave our street because they had one measly snowplow, and it didn't even come to our street. So
that must have been horrible then, with the cabin fever setting in after a few days.
Yeah. I mean, I like to say that, I mean, Lubbock is a good place to be a writer because there aren't as many distractions. And Syracuse was kind of like that too. But yeah, you need some variety.
You need to have some experiences. Write what you know about that BS thing.
Yeah.
But can you be a writer without having a life?
I mean, Emily Dickinson did it.
Kind of, sort of, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she had more of a life than I think people often give her credit for. And certainly a very, very rich inner life. Yeah, I mean, I think you need to be alive. You need to be observing what's happening inside you and around you, you know, as much as you can, as often as you can, and be open to, you know, being surprised by what you find. I think that's the most important thing, staying open, whatever your kind of living circumstances are.
So it's not necessarily the idea, like, students sometimes have this envisioning of, oh, to be a writer, you must go to Paris or sit in a sad cafe in New Orleans.
Well, I've been to Paris, and I don't know if my writing really got any more interesting after that. I mean, it's showed up in some poems, but I wouldn't say that that's really my subject matter at all, or something that influences me in, you know, any kind of big noticeable way. So yeah, I mean, I think traveling is great, and I think it's good, and I think you kind of have to at some point leave home, whatever that means to you, you know, to find your own way. But you know, that's going to be different for each person. But yeah, I don't think you have to have certain big experiences in order to write.
Just have to experience.
Yeah. Yeah, you just have to experience and be open to what that experience tells you. And it's what you do with that experience, too. It's the imagination that comes in. I mean, I started out as a fiction writer, actually. So I still love just making things up. And I think that that's very valuable for writing poems, too. That imaginative capacity. You know, like, yeah, often I am drawing from real experiences, but there has to be that element of surprise, that thing that I didn't expect, and sometimes that's something that is completely fictional.
Writers are the best liars.
Yeah, I often tell people about this, but when I met the poet Jean Valentine, she came to my college for a reading and a signing, and I went to get a book of hers signed, and when I went up, I told her that it was my birthday that week. It wasn't my birthday that day. I told her, she asked me what day it was, and I told her, and she said, okay, well, writers can lie. So when she signed the book, she wrote the date as my birthday, which I thought was really sweet, and also just very kind of an educational moment, too, about, yeah, you know, this is what writers do.
The students I have, at least, I've talked to or have had in the past, have this, I always tell them, it's like, and I've spoken on the program about this, have this false impression of us as like these isolated, tormented souls. And I'm like, no, we play Mario Kart together.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it's funny. My partner, when we first started dating, he thought, because we talked a lot about creativity because he plays music. And I think there are a lot of overlaps in terms of the creative process and, you know, just what you do, you know, musicians, writers. So we talked a lot about that. And then later he's told me that he first thought I was like so serious and that I didn't watch TV, when that is the complete, that's a complete kind of illusion, I guess. I love television. I still watch probably too much than I should. But that was actually one of the first things that made me want to become a writer, because I was thinking about the writing on these shows. And I mean, TV writers don't get nearly enough credit for, you know, what they make. So that was something that, yeah, growing up just watching TV and then starting to learn about what actually went into these shows and who was writing them got me very interested in writing.
What TV do you love? Let me rephrase that. It's too broad.
Okay.
Your favorite TV shows of all time or currently airing?
Of all time, I'd say definitely Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That's the show that, yeah, really got me into thinking about TV as its own art form. You know, there's still episodes of that show that I go back to and think about the writing of that show and, you know, how it was structured and, you know, how they got the characters to develop in the ways they did. So the craft of it. Yeah, that was the first show and remains primary. Also Twin Peaks, which I only watched kind of recently. I think when I was in Syracuse, I watched it one winter break. And another writer in the program, a friend of mine, is obsessed with that show. So we've had conversations about it and about the reboot. And for Halloween one year, we all dressed up as characters from the show. Even my partner, who hasn't seen the show, we made him dress up as Kyle MacLachlan's character on that show, the detective.
What did you dress up as?
I dressed up as the log lady. Yeah, so Jeff made me the log out of paper. And then I just wore like a very nice sweater and acted weird. Yeah.
Twin Peaks is one of those shows on my hit list on Netflix. I still have to sit down and watch it one of these days.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it is like very much of its period too, but it's so like wonderfully over the top.
Just, it feels like perfect David Lynch then.
Yeah. Really purposeful melodrama, I would say.
When you watch the show, I'm told, just go with it. Don't ask questions, just go with it.
Yeah, it definitely gets pretty surreal and very dreamlike and lyrical, which I like as a poet, but it can be kind of disorienting at first.
Much like anything David Lynch does. It's like, right. I think The Simpsons put it best about Twin Peaks. Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah. I have absolutely no idea what's going on.
But I think the episodic format does help make that show, like, it's definitely, like, you can definitely follow the narrative still, you know, because episode by episode, like, it has to develop like any other TV show in that way.
What are you currently watching? Is there anything that's grabbing you right now?
Yeah, I've been binge watching Weeds on Netflix, which is a show that I had watched a couple episodes of it like years ago. I think it ended in 2012. So now all 8 seasons are on Netflix. So I've been watching that like crazy. Really impressed with the writing on that show too. Just hilarious lines on that show. And Jeff and I have been watching Jane the Virgin, although he sort of spoiled it for himself because, so we've been watching it on Hulu, and sometimes they will update kind of the banner or the particular logo for the show, and you can sort of like get a preview of what the new season of the show just like looks like. And sometimes I can tell you like just enough about what the character dynamics are going to be like that it ends up being a bit of a spoiler. He's feeling a little disappointed by that.
I know the feeling. I was watching I watched a couple shows on Netflix, and sometimes even the preview images or the episode summary of that season, you're like, episode 5, and some character's in deep trouble, but you're like, but they're still going to be in it by episode 10 because they're in the synopsis. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of accidental spoiling that goes on. I mean, it's kind of unavoidable, you know, when you're watching a show that has already aired and has been around for a while, so.
Is there a statute of limitations on spoilers? Like, you're okay talking about spoilers after a certain date?
For me, personally, or just in general?
Well, what's your take on that? Like, okay, I can understand if an episode airs or a movie comes out, you wait at least a week. But when does that no longer null and void? 6 months? 10 years?
Personally, I like knowing as little as possible before I watch something. So I will avoid spoilers pretty hardcore because I just don't like kind of having my impression shaped by anything else before I just experience the thing. I also understand that it's kind of impossible to completely avoid it, you know, and when people are excited and, you know, want to talk about a show or a movie that's like just come out. So there's this other part of me then that recognizes that and also thinks that if, you know, if the show is any good, then it would be worth rewatching anyway. And so it shouldn't matter as much, you know, if the show is just dependent on these kind of like shocking twists or cliffhangers, then, you know, then maybe it isn't as quality of a show. But, you know, there's more to it. You know, the characters are really fully developed. The story goes in surprising emotional directions that can't be, you know, summed up easily. You know, you can't reduce it to that summary or that spoiler. So, you know, in that case, I don't really mind eventually.
Do you have spoiler vision? There are a few people I've met that you can tell them a spoiler and they will forget it somehow.
I mean, I'm sure it's happened to me with the amount of television that I watch. So, yeah. And I mean, even with some of my favorite shows, I mean, the nice thing is kind of like forgetting exactly what happened. So then when you rewatch it, certain things, they're not necessarily like as surprising, but you can have this fun moment of, you know, suddenly remembering that that's what happened.
You mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I finally watched that series about 4 years ago, let's say. Yeah. Loved it. And I remember certain episodes, but I can't tell you plots. I'll have to think for a moment, go like, what season was the whole Riley issue? Was it 3 or 4?
Season 4. Okay. Often cited by fans as the worst season of the show, in large part because of Riley.
Where do you fall on that? Because I have heard that debate. Yeah. Where do you fall on it? Is Riley the tool of the devil, or is he okay?
I think he's just a very bland character, but I think, in a way, that's the point. That Buffy went from dating or, you know, just being in this epic romance with Angel, you know, the kind of classic star-crossed romance. And it's like, how do you come back after that? Or like, what's her next relationship going to be like? So I think in a way, it's a smart storytelling choice to just give her someone normal for a change. I mean, he had his own issues, as it was revealed in that season, but someone who seems like this very regular guy on a college campus, like someone that you would date in college, you know, especially after having such an up and down, intense, kind of horrible relationship in a lot of ways. Yeah, so it made a kind of storytelling sense that that would be the next relationship. But I just don't think they gave him much else to do besides sort of filling that role, especially compared to like all these other characters who are so richly developed. You know, you have Giles, Willow, Oz, and then Tara comes in the fourth season.
And you have some really great episodes that season, like the much-lauded Hush episode.
Right. And the episode where Giles gets turned into a demon.
Which is a great physical comedy episode.
Yeah.
When I saw it, I understood why people hated Riley, but I liked him from the get-go. I'm like, I think you're right. It seems to almost back up the movie, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when she has that great line that's like, all I want to do is graduate from high school, go to Europe, marry Christian Slater, and die. Because she doesn't want the Slayer mantle.
Right, yeah, so he's like the normal college guy that she gets to date for that season, and part of season 5, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think the other thing with that season is that, yeah, there are these really great standout episodes, but I do think it was less compelling of a whole season with its arc. So, you know, compared to, I think especially like season 2 or season 3, where you get this really strong sense of the trajectory of these stories, you know, serial storytelling at its best, I think. And so for a whole season, you can, you know, follow these characters. And I think season 4, and again, I think I can see like the storytelling reason behind it, you know, because they're going to college, just this transitional phase. So there are going to be these kind of awkward things, you know, and they're growing and the show is growing and trying to find, you know, a new identity for itself, you know, after leaving high school. You know, like, what is the premise going to be now? Because for the first three seasons, you know, Joss Whedon, the creator, has said that, you know, they're in high school and, you know, all these demons, you know, are these metaphors, and high school is hell is kind of the tagline of those first three seasons. So when they go to college, it's like, oh, what is it now? Are we going to still do these kind of Monster of the Week episodes and, you know, have these very clear kind of metaphors for, you know, growing up? What does that mean now? What does growing up mean, you know, going to college? So, yeah.
Dare I ask who your favorite character is?
I would say Anya, who comes in later in the show. And I think she was just a recurring character. I think she was supposed to just be a guest star initially, you know, for like two episodes. And then people just liked her so much that she became a recurring character and then a regular later in the series. And yeah, so she is a vengeance demon. And I don't know what else to say without giving away too much.
Except she has her. I think her moment in the musical episode is fantastic. And yeah. Then, without spoiling it for those who've never seen it, the recall in season 7 of that musical.
That episode, yeah, the Anya episode in season 7 is amazing.
I think I lost it. Like, I just jaw dropped when that happened. The flashback where they're something like...
Yeah, I love how committed the writers get to their own premises. So that, you know, it's like, oh, we have this vengeance demon that is like centuries old and has lived through all these upheavals in history. And we can go back to these periods if we want to, but really like have fun with these different periods.
Kind of take the genres that it plays in and reverse them or defy your expectations of. Okay. Anya's boss,
right,
is one of my favorite sub-characters on the show.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that says something about a show when even a minor character ultimately can become like a fan favorite or beloved. And you just look forward to their next appearance, even if it's not for like half a season, but you see them again and you're so happy.
Beyond Buffy, did you ever get into Angel or any of the tie-ins?
Yeah, I got into Angel, but I think that's also a pretty good show, especially the later seasons of that show, actually. Yeah, I didn't get quite as obsessed with it, I guess. Maybe because, I mean, the humor of Buffy just spoke to me and still speaks to me in such a deeply personal way and has like shaped me as a person, shaped my own sense of humor that, yeah, you just can't really compete with that.
I'd been told about the show in the 90s. I didn't watch it then. It wasn't my thing. I didn't think it was. But eventually someone told me, no, the humor is excellent. So my wife was like, here, watch a couple episodes with me. And I was like, this is kind of neat. Let's watch it from the beginning now. And we started watching it from the beginning and watched the whole series. I'm like, okay, this is one of the greatest shows I missed out on.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, like, the show, like, it sounds so silly, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Such a, like, kind of silly name for a show. And I think there are some very silly premises on the show, and it can be very campy, which is also its charm, I think, sometimes. But yeah, it's a show that stays with you. And I think, I mean, that's what I look for in any new show that I'm watching. It's that care for the characters, you know. You know, do these characters make sense in the kind of, like, irrational sense of human beings? And do I want to get invested in, you know, where the show is going to take them?
I totally understand. I watched 3 episodes of The Walking Dead, and I just looked at the characters. I'm like, I don't care if any of you live or die. I'm out.
Yeah, that's sort of the test. I feel that way. I feel that way more in the movies, too. And I guess it's a little unfair because you have kind of less time in a movie, you know, 2 hours compared to dozens and dozens of hours with a show to really, you know, get these characters right and make you care about them. Because with a TV show, like, you know, the first season or the first half of the season could be kind of rocky, but then it can get really good. So it depends. But yeah, it's that test of, do I care if you live or die?
I feel like we came to this topic a little bit late in the show this time, because I feel like you and I could have a long discussion about not only Buffy, but probably many other shows.
Yes.
So I am going to put it out there and say, feel free to come back on this program whenever you want.
And talk about TV.
And just talk about TV. We can just have a TV party on here sometime. But before we let you go today, Chen, where can the folks find you online? Well, let me back up and ask first, what you got coming out? I know you got a book coming out next year, I believe?
Yeah. So my first full-length collection, which is called When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities, is coming out from Boa Editions next spring, next April, I believe. Yeah, so that's the big thing to look out for, I guess.
You got anything else coming down the pike right now? Stuff you're working on, maybe?
Yeah, I'm always working on poems and trying to also work on some essays, some academic essays, but I think I might try my hand at some personal essays too, taking a nonfiction class this fall. So that might be something on the horizon. But yeah, the poems are kind of my main priority.
So where can the folks find you online? They want to check out your stuff, want to get to know you a little bit beyond the show.
You can go to chenchenwrites.com. Everything will be there.
Excellent. Well, and of course, social media.
Yes. So, Twitter and Instagram. It's also Chen Chen Writes.
Excellent. And I encourage our listeners to go out and check you out, because it has been awesome chatting with you. I'm so glad we got the chance to talk.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun.
And feel free to come back anytime. We'll discuss more about the Whedon universe and I'm sure many other TV shows.
Yes, the Whedonverse.
So I'm wondering how many years I've got left before my brain is totally melted from the amount of TV I watched as a kid. Right.
Yeah. Well, and two, also, I mean, because he's been doing the Avengers movies, so.
Ah, yes.
It's a whole nother world.
And now that he's like, never again, I'm out. Where's he going to go now? I want to see him do a little more like his Shakespeare movie there.
Oh, yeah. Kind of his like student art film
with famous friends,
right? With famous friends, because he shot it at his house, I think, over like just a week or two.
Just asked a bunch of people, hey, want to do a Shakespeare? I'm gonna just film it.
Yeah, because they'd already been doing that for many years with actors on his shows. They would just get together and do these kind of Shakespeare parties. So he was like, oh, why don't we actually just make a movie out of this?
Definitely one to check out. But until then, Chen, thank you for being here.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
The SAFTA Cast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.